Well, the title of my message is The 10 Words, and I want to tell you that a couple of weeks ago, Diane and I were in Edmonton late on a Saturday night, and as we were coming home, thought that we would, get back to Red Deer fairly lickety-split. But just after Leduc, we encountered a bunch of fog, and this was really thick. It's almost like East Coast fog, and initially, you're not quite sure what to do. Do you pull over? Do you hit the brake? I put on my high beams, and of course, that just made it worse. You recognize fairly quickly that what you need to do is keep your eye on the lines in the center of the road and the lines over on the shoulder. And if you do that and just keep your vehicle in between those two boundaries, it's not a problem. You can drive. The only unfortunate thing would be if somebody had slowed down in front of you or had stalled because you had about zero visibility. But the lines really do make a difference. You take them for granted. You don't even know they're there. But when there's fog, that's how you can drive. Keep an eye on the boundaries. And that reminds me of the story that we want to look at today in the book of Deuteronomy. God's people were being prepared to enter the promised land, and in order for them to be successful, Moses had said that they had to be faithful. God had said, if you will trust in me, I will fight for you. And if I fight for you, you will be successful in engaging the enemy. And so it seems like for them, Moses was laying down some tracks. He was identifying some boundaries. And if they stayed within those boundaries, they would experience success. I'd like to read the passage to you from Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 6 to 21. You know, it's one thing for God to say, I need you to be faithful. I want you to be faithful. It's another thing to be told, what would faithfulness look like? And today as we look at the Ten Commandments, I think that one of the things that we will see is that this is an excellent description of what faithfulness looks like in the life of faith. Deuteronomy 5:6. I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Let's go down to verse 11. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Verse 12. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath day to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. Verse 15. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Verse 16. Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that you may live long and it may go well with you in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not set your desire on your neighbor's house or land, his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. A number of years ago, there was an attempt to try to summarize and contemporize the Ten Commandments. These apparently were posted on the wall of a church in Gainesboro, Tennessee. If nothing else, I think you'll agree they're to the point. They're also out of order. 1. Just one God. 2. Honor your ma and pa. 3. No telling tales or gossiping. 4. Get yourself to Sunday meeting. 5. Put nothing before God. 6, no fooling around with another fellow's gal. 7, no killing. 8, watch your mouth. 9, don't take what ain't yours. And 10, don't be hankering with your buddy's stuff. Let me give you a few facts about the Ten Commandments. The expression is literally the 10 words. The Hebrew word rendered commandment actually means words or utterance or statements, the 10 words. The 10 commandments are really an example of summarization. We just love when we see a body of material, we just very naturally want to summarize and simplify. I noticed when Walter was reading a passage today that part of what his comments did was nicely summarize and synthesize what he had read. Jewish rabbis analyzed the Old Testament, and they found there 613 commandments. Some of them were positive, you thou shalt, and some of them were negative, thou shalt not. But there were actually 613 commandments in the Torah. So what Moses, inspired by God, is doing here is he's taking a large body of material and he is simplifying it and synthesizing it into 10 key statements. And aren't we glad he did? This is the cream. This is the gist. But then many years later, our Lord did much the same thing. Someone came to him and said, "What of all the things that the Bible tells us about God's will, what is it that is the most important? How can you boil it down?" And so having gone from 613 to 10, Jesus boiled it down further to just what I would call one thing with two parts: love God and others. So we see this tradition of synthesizing going on in the Bible. The Ten Commandments basically contain two kinds of obligations, two sets of obligations. There are 4 obligations to God, and then there are 6 obligations to people. Do you think you know the Ten Commandments? If we gave you a quiz this morning, would you be able to name them? I was having lunch with John Ooster this week, and we were talking about it, and he wasn't sure if he knew all of them. And as we conversed with one another, it was obvious to both of us that, yeah, he actually did. Whether you've sat down and tried to memorize all of them, most of us know what they are, and we have them pretty well in hand. Living them, well, that's another matter. Some facts about the Ten Commandments. What is the context of the commandments? If you were to frame the Ten Commandments, what would that frame be? I'd like to suggest that the proper frame for the Ten Commandments is redemption. It's what God had done for his people. In fact, we read that in the preamble in verse 6. God identifies himself. He says, "I, the one who is declaring these Ten Commandments, I am the one who brought you out of Egypt." In other words, I'm the Redeemer. I've rescued you. You are safe. You belong to me. The reason why you belong to me is because I've redeemed you. I did it. I did for you what you couldn't do for yourself. You're mine. You belong to me. And so the starting point of the Ten Commandments really isn't what we do. It's what God has already done. They had been rescued. They were redeemed. The Ten Commandments, then, are an explanation of what people who are redeemed, this is how they should live. This is what their lives ought to look like. If we think that the purpose of the Ten Commandments is so that we might redeem ourselves or somehow achieve salvation, the Bible would shake its head and say, "No, you didn't get it. You missed the point." It's rather a description of what people who already enjoy redemption, this is what their lives look like. Does that make sense? Okay. I think that's important. Paul in 1 Corinthians 6 puts it nicely. And he was always so good at reminding people that salvation isn't something that we achieve. It's something we receive. And there's a difference. It's not something we achieve. It's something we receive. In 1 Corinthians 6, he reminds this pretty badly banged up bunch of Christians in Corinth. He said, you are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. The command presupposes a prior relationship with God. It's as though God is saying in the Old Testament as well as in the New Testament, you're mine by redemption. I own you. And because I own you, you owe me. That's the order of salvation. And that's the order of doing good. Well, we're going to have to move quickly through the content of the commandments. Each one of these is worth a sermon. But we are not doing that. We're not giving you 10 sermons. We're just giving you one. So the 10 commandments then, two sets of obligations, are obligations to God. Verse 7, we have an obligation to respect his uniqueness. The Lord said, you shall have no other gods before me, just me. There's no one like me. I have no peers. There is no one you can compare me to. There's just me. We respect God's uniqueness. To use the old language, he brooks no rivals. Second obligation is to respect his exclusive worship. Don't make images. Don't make images of me. I'm jealous. There are no other gods, so you can't make an image of another god. And if you tried to make an image of me, it would be a distortion. It's like a political cartoon. You know what political cartoonists do? They latch onto a feature and then they distort it. I'm sure that our prime minister's wife would not like that drawing of her husband, or Justin's mother would not feel as though the artist had really done the nose the work that it deserved. And it's like Moses is saying, don't make images of God, because you'll never get it right and you will always get it wrong. Besides, he's invisible. 3, we have an obligation to respect his name. Verse 11, you shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. Now, when I was a kid, I was taught that this was profanity, you know, just plain and simple. I'm not so sure that it's quite that simple. I'm sure that it does cover profanity, and we're not to use the Lord's name in vain like that. But it also describes acting in ways that reflect poorly on God. After all, we belong to God, remember, by virtue of redemption. And because we belong to God, we're his, and now we have to learn to behave like it. How does one misuse the name of the Lord their God? Well, you could try to juice up a promise by invoking God's name. And that's often what happens in a court of law. Do you swear to tell the truth, whole truth, nothing but the truth? So help you God? They always juice it up with God's name. And then the person says, of course. But if they go ahead and lie, then they have misused the name of the Lord their God. I think a more profound way of looking at this, though, is times when we are charged with the responsibility of acting as God's agents and then don't. Have any of you seen that publication called The Shepherd's Guide? I think we have some of them here at the chapel. You can pick one up probably at the back. It's kind of like a Yellow Pages for Christians. And let's suppose that you were a plumber, and you put your little ad in there, and you put all the vitals on how we can contact you, and then at the bottom you put the little symbol, fish, you know, that proves that you're a Christian, right? And for good measure you throw in a cross. But then when people come to you for plumbing services, they discover that you're a liar, you're a cheat, that you're not who you claim to be. You, my friend, would then be guilty of misusing the name of the Lord your God. A far worse example of this, of course, would be residential schools. You probably know that for over 100 years, the federal government funded Indian residential schools in this country. But did you know that they were primarily managed by faith communities, Catholics and Protestants? And there were some very ugly and awful things that happened there. That is an example of misusing the name of the Lord your God. people who were charged with the responsibility of acting for God. This was almost like a mission. This was supposed to be a missional venture. And things went oh so wrong because people misused the name of the Lord. 4, respect for his day. We need a lot of time here, but we just don't have it. There were two purposes that I can tell for keeping Sabbath. That's how Jews describe it, keeping Sabbath. Are you keeping Sabbath today? How did you keep Sabbath last week? It's about keeping Sabbath. Two obvious reasons. One was to keep alive the memory of the Exodus rescue. On the seventh day, one of the reasons why all work was to stop was so people could give some thought to this great deed that God had done in rescuing them. But there was a second reason, and it's nicely described in Exodus 31. The expression there is quite graphic. It's a picture of people who are catching their breath. One of the reasons for Sabbath was so that people could catch their breath. They've been working for 6 days, and on the seventh day, you think you can go to work and be productive? Try doing that week after week, month after month. I actually know some people who try to do it. I don't think they do it very well. But that was one of the purposes of Sabbath, was to just sit down and catch your breath. How do we do that today? Books have been written about this. How do we keep Sabbath today? I think it's interesting that the early Christians moved their day of gathering and formal worship from the seventh day, Saturday, to the first day, Sunday. Do you know why they did that? They did that in honor of the resurrection of Jesus, right? So you probably knew that. What I find fascinating is that by the time we get to the book of Romans, Christians are starting to argue and disagree over how to deal with these holy days, one of which would have been the Sabbath. This was brought to Paul's attention. You know, some were saying, we can do it on this day or this day, and others are saying, no, we should go back to the Sabbath, and others are probably saying we should do it on the first day. They probably expected the apostles to lay down some hard and fast rules. They would have been disappointed. Listen to what Paul says in Romans 14:5. One person considers one day more sacred than another. Another considers every day alike. Each of them should be fully convinced in their own mind. I understand him to be saying that, you know, the really big deal is not the day that you do it. The really big deal is that you do it, that you gather. And when you gather, there are certain things that you want to remember. One of which, of course, is the great act of redemption. I understand that there is an element of freedom that the church enjoys. But sometimes freedom is so easy to abuse, isn't it? Probably why our parents were so reluctant when we were teenagers to give us too much rope. They were afraid we'd hang ourselves. The writer to the Hebrews was well aware of this, and he warned his readers. Maybe he was aware of what these Roman Christians had been disagreeing about. And he writes them, and he warns them against not giving up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing. Some people found out that, you know, the big deal isn't that we do it on Sunday or Saturday. Maybe we don't even need to do it. The writer to the Hebrews was concerned that they would come to that conclusion. I understand that we do need to honor the Lord's Day. By the way, do a concordance search sometime on the Lord's Day, especially in the book of the Revelation. When we do it isn't a big deal, but the day of the Lord should be honored. How would you feel if your parents told you this year, if you're a younger person, we know you've got a birthday coming up, and we know all your life we've been telling you, this is your day, but this year we're just going to forget it. What do you think? Probably not a good idea. Guys, I would not advise you to do that with your wife's special day. Now, you know, you're probably like Diane and I. There are years when it's just not possible to do it on the day, the specific calendar day. And so we'll move it around a day or two or maybe even a week and it's no big deal because we do it. We honor the day. I think that every Christian community has to sort this out. I've pastored churches that did it Sunday night, and that was fine. There are some groups, probably here in Red Deer, certainly in Edmonton, that honor the Lord's Day on a Friday night or a Saturday night. The big deal isn't when you do it, but that you do it. Those are four obligations that the Ten Commandments describe for God, obligations to God. And then the last six are obligations that we have to mankind. There are some things that, because God owns us, we owe him, and we also owe other people. So number five is respect your parents. Honor your father and mother. In the Bible, parents possess what we sometimes refer to as gravitas. They have weight. They have significance. They are important, and that is why they need to be honored. How do you do that? Well, it's pretty straightforward when you're young and living at home. You just do what they tell you, pretty much. That's your responsibility, unless they ask you to do something illegal, which my parents never did. But when you get a little older, and you move out, and maybe you get married, then it's time to get out those scissors and make sure that you do something to the apron strings, right? Now, sometimes this doesn't happen. And when it doesn't happen, there are problems. Sometimes the parents won't let it happen or don't want it to happen. And sometimes it's the couple themselves who don't want it to happen. But once that's done, your responsibility is to stay in touch. That's one way that you honor your parents. Just stay in touch. Make sure they're not the last ones to find out that you're having surgery. My son Matt recently had some surgery on his knee, and he made the mistake of not letting his mother know that he was having it, and I think he got bawled out for it, and rightly so. We honor our parents by praying for them. We just bring them to God, and we ask him to do good things for them. We honor our parents by visiting them, just showing up once in a while. Last summer, my son and his wife were in Abbotsford, and they went to visit my mom, so Matt's grandma. I think the principle holds, and they spent a whole day with grandma. My mom has not stopped talking about the day that her grandson and his wife came, and they spent the whole day with me, she said. It meant so much to her. We honor our parents by helping them. I have a friend who works for a Christian organization in Edmonton. His parents are in Singapore, and he just found out that his father is quite ill, and so he's taking 3 months' leave to go and be with his father and help them through this difficult time. And then finally, we honor our parents. Sometimes it's as simple as expressing affection. For some of us, that's hard because we didn't grow up in homes that were used to expressing affection. And so we've had to learn to do this. We've had to learn to hug. We've had to learn to, you know, give the quick little kiss on the cheek. We've had to learn how to say, "We love you. I love you." Hard to do, but it means so much and expresses our respect for our parents. Six, we are obligated to show respect for life. You shall not murder. Thankfully, that's not a real issue here at the chapel yet. But let's think of it in terms of respecting life. I think essentially the commandment means no unauthorized killing allowed. It's not dealing with war. It's not dealing with capital punishment. Those are separate issues. It's not dealing with the work of law enforcement. That's different. Those, we would say, are exceptions to the rule. The rule is no unauthorized killing. How do we do this? Well, essentially, we do this by being pro-life. And I really dislike it that the term pro-life has been co-opted by the anti-abortion movement. It's good, I think, to be anti-abortion, but there is way more to being pro-life than being anti-abortion. If you're truly pro-life, you may regularly donate to a food bank. If you're really pro-life, you may give blood. I have an appointment to give blood in a few weeks. If you're really pro-life, you might sign your organ donor's card. It just shows that you're about enhancing life. You're about extending life. If it lies within my power to do that, I will do it. If you're really pro-life, you may support a compassion kid or a world vision kid. That has been such a delight for Diane and I over the past couple of years. We've had a couple of kids that we've supported, and we would love sometime to go and see them, but for now, we settle with letters and other forms of communication. If you're really pro-life, you'll do the best job that you possibly can at raising your kids, and maybe, just maybe, you might be called upon to raise your kids' kids. Do you know we have a couple of families here at the chapel who, after having raised their own children, are now raising their children's children because of some special circumstances? So heroic, so selfless. That is pro-life. That is respecting life. 7, respect marriage. You shall not commit adultery. It's not that complicated. Don't ever intrude on someone else's marriage and their marital vows. Respect your own vows. By the way, men, how many of us know what we vowed our wife on our wedding day? If somebody put a 45 to your head, could you write them down on a piece of paper? I keep mine in my wallet, and I pull them out sometimes, and I review them so that I don't forget. Like the rest of you, I have a better forgettery than I have a memory. Know your vows. Easier to keep them if you know them. Mind them. Cultivate your love life. And by that I mean, first of all, learn to speak your spouse's love language. You can buy a book, and it nicely describes the different ways that people receive love. Your spouse may be the kind of person who, if you really want to convincingly say, I love you, you'll have to spend quality time with them. That's their love language. Or maybe it's gifts. Gifts really communicate. That's how they know they're loved. That's how they feel they're loved. Be good for all of us to read the book, 5 Love Languages, learn our partner's love language, and then practice speaking it. Hebrews 13:4. Let marriage be held in honor among all. Could it be clearer? Respect your own marriage vows. I'm to respect your marriage vows. You're to respect my marriage vows. You shall not commit adultery. There would be a lot less adultery if people consistently did that. 8, we are to respect property. Verse 19, you shall not steal. Don't know that that's a real problem here at the chapel. Basically means don't help yourself to what doesn't belong to you. Respect the property rights of others. Resist small theft. Do you know that people who become big-time thieves didn't start out as big-time thieves? They started out as little-time thieves. When my mom was here last weekend, we just peppered her with all kinds of questions about her life when she was younger. And she reminded us that when she came off the farm and moved to Winnipeg, she was a maid. She was a uniform-wearing maid working for some rich people in Winnipeg. And she told us that the lady of the house would often leave change, you know, coins, on the top of tables and counters. And my mom always thought that it was a test. She always thought they were testing her. Being a good Mennonite girl, of course, she would never touch it. But resist small theft. If you borrowed it, return it. That's kind of simple. Respect other people's property. Don Falk used to be my neighbor, sort of. Fred and Linda and Don and Judy lived down the other end of the street where we lived. And this was our first house. We didn't have all the tools and stuff that Don and Judy did. And so I was regularly going down there, borrowing this, that, and the other thing. And one day, Don, I think he was making a joke. And he said, I finally figured out what the B in your name is, Terry B. Weeb. B is for borrow. If you borrow it, return it. And finally, know the laws about copying. Okay, we have this amazing tool called a copy machine. And there are actually laws about what you can and can't. And churches need to know this and practice this because we are in the business of copying things for all kinds of different reasons. I have a brother who used to teach a seminar on copyright law, and he would love to talk to us about that. That's 8, respect for property. 9, respect for truth, verse 20, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. In other words, don't tell lies. Just love the truth and respect the truth. Have confidence in the truth, even your truth. Of course, tell the truth in court, but also tell the truth in the parking lot. And in aisle 7 at Superstore, when you meet, you know, somebody else that you know, and you're just talking about stuff, tell the truth. Don't embellish the truth. Preachers fall into that. If you ever catch me embellishing the truth, you should sit me down and we should chat about that. Sometimes when people tell stories, I find that they so embellish it. The stories that they tell, they always feature themselves as the hero. And the other guy is the schmuck. And after the fourth or the fifth time, you get a little suspicious. You know, learn to tell the truth about yourself as well, not just the truth about others. And then 10, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and so on. I call this respect for imagination. God has given us this remarkable capacity to hold ideas and values in our imagination. And we are responsible for what we put in the basket. You can put all kinds of stuff in the basket of your imagination. Some of it is righteous and good, and some of it is just bad and evil. And if you keep it there long enough, if you let it linger long enough, it'll burn you. And it'll push you and encourage you in directions that you really ought not to be moving in. Watch what you want. Discipline your wants. Okay, time to land this. A better way to live. Moses is talking to the children of Israel, preparing them on the plains of Moab to enter the promised land. He wants them to be faithful, because if they are faithful, God will fight for them and things will go well. And so God reminds them that they enjoy redemption. God owns you. He really does. God owns you. And he lays claim to us and all that we have. And whenever we obey this God who owns us, we are showing him that we get it. He wants us to get it. I get it that I'm redeemed. I get it that I belong to you. I get it that I'm yours. And I owe you something. And what I owe you is my obedience and my loyalty. If you're here today and you don't know this God, you don't believe in him, come and speak to me afterwards. I'd love to introduce you to him. Most of us here today know this God, and he loves you, and he has done so much for you. Before he ever says, now, I'd like you to do this, before he ever gets to that conversation, he just blesses you and gives you good gifts. And only after that initial encounter of God's grace does he then come and ask us to be loyal to him. Let's pray. Thank you for these 10 words, for the way that they have shaped civilizations over the millennia. They really have. And thank you for the way that they can also shape our lives and our relationships right here at Balmoral and in Rosedale or wherever we might live. Thank you that you love us. Help us to give you what we owe you. Amen.